Deezer Originals.
Now, it's time for Strong and Stable.
Strong and Stable, 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 Strong and Stable.
Hello and welcome to Strong and Stable, the topical podcast that no longer costs 55 pence a minute to listen to and will still be an absolute shambles. I'm your host Aisha Hazarika, and in the news this week, the new UKIP leader Henry Bolton said he could strangle a badger with his bare hands. Clearly a dig at former leader Paul Nuttall, who actually invented badgers. The government denied that it has a let-them-eat-cake attitude to universal credit claimants, especially as cake will not be available for the first 6 weeks. And a red sun appeared over most of the UK, except on Merseyside, where it's banned. And helping me peer through the apocalyptic gloom of this week's news are our guests. Helen Lewis is a journalist and the deputy editor of The New Statesman. And I really, really wanted to make a Helen Lewis and the news joke, but I just couldn't get it to work, even when I used the power of love. Helen, I'm so sorry they made me do that gag. Anna Soubry is the Conservative MP for Broxtow. Anna once accused Boris Johnson of putting his leadership ambitions ahead of Britain's future. Although that's not saying much, as Boris puts his annual trip to the hairdressers ahead of Britain's future. And Fred McCauley, a comedian and radio presenter. Fred is known for his humorous exploits in aid of charitable causes, including singing in Comic Relief Does Fame Academy and climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. Although there's one humorous challenge for a needy cause he has turned down, and that's managing Scotland's football team. Welcome, dear guests. Hello, how are you all?
Hello, very well, thank you.
Well, thank you for coming.
Terrible puns. Terrible.
I know,
puns.
I'm sorry, they make me do it. They just make me do it. I'm just sitting here like in sort of comedy slavery. They make me. They won't feed me otherwise, Anna. Now, Anna, I have to say, as I was telling people I was coming to this podcast, I was at a do with lots of Labour staffers, and do you know what the enduring meme was? I love Soubers. Mm. You have so many
Soubs.
Do you know how popular you are amongst kind of Labour people in a really weird way?
It's quite funny, really, isn't it? It just shows you the whole world has gone completely mad. And it shows, actually, the complete meltdown that is occurring in both of the two main political parties. And that means, frankly, great for all those people who are watching politics and commentating on politics. Pretty rubbish, I think, for the people of this country. But it also says anything but anything could happen.
Mm-hmm. The other message that I've had is a really special request, is that Anna, the Soubs, has got the best voice in politics. So I've just been asked to ask you to say two words: hard Brexit.
I should try and do my Margaret Thatcher impersonation. A hard Brexit.
Oh, that was so
good. If only. And can I just say, actually, it's only a matter of time till I do get the Scotland job. Everybody gets a turn.
Have you had the call yet?
No, but I know very little about football, so I'm the perfect candidate.
Have you started your own petition?
No, but you've known me for years, Aisha, and there is a great Scotland chant, which is, mathematically, we might still qualify. Sadly, it no longer applies to the current World Cup.
So this week, David Davis played down Amber Rudd's claim that a no-deal Brexit would be unthinkable, as that would suggest some level of thought. While Chris Grayling claimed that the UK would produce more food in the event of a no-deal Brexit, namely humble pie and the egg dripping off Theresa May's face. Liam Fox accused the BBC of reporting Brexit with a tone of self-defeating pessimism, which is strange, as I could have sworn that the BBC's motto is "Nation shall speak truth unto nation," not "Nation shall speak airbrushed, fluffed up, pro-Brexit version of the truth unto government." Still, it's not just the right who are complaining about bias in journalism right now. "The explosion in public opinion is problematic," wrote Owen Jones in a 1,000-word opinion piece for The Guardian. So, dear guests, how do you feel about a no-deal Brexit? Anna, I'd like to start with you.
Well, here's a surprise. I think a no-deal Brexit would be the very worst outcome for our country. It's bad enough that we're leaving the European Union, but to leave without any deal is the stuff of complete madness. I think, to be fair, Amber said that it was unthinkable that we wouldn't get a deal on security. She was talking about that. And I think we will get something on security, but it's the idea we would crash out onto WTO World Trade Organization rules without a proper trading arrangement in place. I mean, I have the perfect solution.
What is that?
Take it off the shelf. Very simple and easy. We stay a member of the customs union. We stay in the single market. We do the best thing by our economy, by the future of our country. It's all there for the taking. If only the government could have the courage to do that.
Oh, that sounds quite revolutionary. Well,
why not go one step further and just stay in Europe altogether?
Because unfortunately, we had this thing called a referendum. And when we voted to have a referendum, and people of all parties voted for a referendum, we said we would be bound by the result. And even though I voted against my conscience and against everything I've ever believed in, I had to, and rightly, be true to the promise I made to the people of Broxtowe that whatever the result, I would adhere to that result and I would honour it. And that's why we're leaving.
But the thing about referenda is that you have a result and then you stick with it for a small period of time and then you think about having another one. That's the way we're doing it in Scotland.
Yeah, but you've rejected the second referendum very sensibly.
Well, it's just been put in the shelf for a wee while.
But one of the things I just want to actually turn to Helen about is that there's been a lot of criticism about how the media is dealing with Brexit. Liam Fox seems to think that the BBC stands for Brexit Bashing Corporation. Do you think the media have been a bit Ramone, Helen?
I think certainly most journalists live in London, have degrees, and therefore are all the cultural stereotypes you associate with Remainers. I think probably the vast majority of people working in the media probably did work.
Do you know any journalists that you hang around with that are friends that voted Brexit?
Yeah, I do. And I'm sure there. You know, so, I mean, I think it's very difficult to separate out what the kind of cultural background of journalists is. And actually, I think that, you know, we'd all agree that is too homogenous from the way that they report. I think actually the BBC, if you're going to have criticisms of it during the referendum campaign, it's that it was hugely biased towards Brexit, because what it did is you had one economist who thought Brexit was a brilliant idea. It was Patrick Minford. He was the one. And then you had literally all the other economists who said this is a terrible idea. And what was your debate? It was two economists. It was Patrick Minford versus one person standing up for all the rest of them. You know, science is exactly the same. It's like putting one climate change denier up against the entire weight of scientific opinion and all this. So what they did is they did this on the one hand, on the other hand stuff. And because they couldn't really kind of commit themselves to say, no, there is such a thing as reality and it has a pro-Remain bias, they ended up being unduly even-handed.
They kind of pioneered alternative facts, didn't they? And of course, we did have Michael Gove saying, oh, we've had enough of these experts. But Fred, in the world of comedy and the stand-up circuit, you know, do you feel there's a balanced view out there? Or is everybody a Ramona who's a comedian and influencer as well?
I would say the majority clearly is. And similarly, at the time of the Scottish referendum, the majority was very much in favour of independence for Scotland in the, you know, in the people in the stand-up world. And, you know, just back in August, Edinburgh Fringe, even then I would ask an audience, you know, saying to them that, look, we are clearly in a democracy. Is there anybody in here? Did you vote Leave? And out of maybe 150 people, you'd get one or two, at which point I would invite them to leave. It's what you voted for. Don't let us keep you back. Out you go. But I didn't really see the BBC as being biased towards Brexit. I mean, that kind of skipped by me, Helen.
Yeah, I think it's the idea of false equivalence, and it's the same thing you saw with Trump versus Clinton. If you look at the coverage, you had kind of Donald Trump has done insert list of enormously long thing. Hillary Clinton used a private email server, and they were all, you know, it was always kind of like, we've done one Trump scandal, so now we have to do a Hillary scandal. And I think that's the difficulty of it, is actually the hardest bit of journalism is about your editorial decisions in terms of what stories you cover and how much prominence you give them. It's not necessarily about writing, you know, everyone thinks immigrants are bad. It's whether or not you do a drip, drip, drip of daily stories going, hey, look at this exceptional case of an immigrant who did something bad, builds up a picture in people's minds. Right. And that's where I think the bias came.
But do you think that it is possible to be a journalist and have kind of neutrality, because it's, you know, if you are going to be a journalist, it's the kind of human condition to have a strong opinion. Do you think it's
of course not. But the one thing you can always be is curious, and actually that's the mark of a bad journalist and a bad writer, is somebody who's not fundamentally curious
Absolutely
about the world
right.
and doesn't ever think, what if I'm wrong? I mean, I try and ask myself, like, once a week, I presume Brexit will be a disaster. At most, you know, at best, I think it will be a long, drawn-out process that leads us into a probably mildly worse place than we were before, and a lot of other things will get neglected. But I do try and sit down and go, OK, what if I'm wrong? And I think that's the thing that I would mark out the difference. Everybody's got opinions. It's about whether or not how rigid and doctrinaire you are about assuming that you have all the answers.
I covered the miners' strike when I was, you know, a journalist at Central TV. And my own views, nobody's interested in my views. And I, you know, you step back, you're detached, and you are able to present the facts. I think the trouble is when you get into commentators and more nuanced arguments. But certainly in terms of reporting your story, absolutely. I'm not interested in your views. And
everyone expects you to have an opinion, but it's just that, you know, the bottom line is it going to cloud your analysis? And as long as that doesn't happen, then that's fair.
And Fred, when I was at the Edinburgh Festival this year, I took part in the session about sort of satire and comedy and politics. And one of the things that came up was, should comedians have a bit, you know, if they believe in something, should they have a responsibility to sort of push a certain political argument or a certain view of the world?
I think undoubtedly they do, yeah. I mean, I did a couple of documentaries about where people are getting their information from, because the news is so skewed one way or another. And over in the States, certainly, you know, The Daily Show and all these other programmes are where a lot of people get their information from now. And that has, you know, that's skewed as well, but it's just happened to be skewed in a more popular way, I would say. But I think if you've got an opinion as a comedian, then you've got to push it.
And but again, it's that narrowness, isn't it? It's about the kind of, I think one of the things I would find very difficult if I was a comedian is the kind of constant encroaching sense, no, this is sacred and we can't joke about this. And you must have this issue with Jeremy Corbyn. Some people will say, but he's a good man and he's doing good things, so don't undermine him, as if doing jokes about times that he, you know, something amusing happens to him is in some way betraying the project. Do you get
Helen,
that?
I get it all. Welcome to my world. Welcome to my world. I had to host the gala dinner at the Labour Party conferences here, and I thought they'd made some mistake. I thought they were going to have to get the canary to check all my jokes before I went on stage, but thankfully that did not happen. Now, channeling her inner Jan Ravens and her inner Sinead O'Connor, it's our Prime Minister, Theresa May.
It's been 15 months and 19 days since we voted to go away. We used to skip and jump and play all day. Then we took our ball away. Since you've been gone, we can buy whatever we want. We can keep out whomever we choose. We can sell our pig's ears to some other trading bloc. But nothing, I said nothing, beats your cars and booze. I said nothing compares to the EU. We'll be so helpless without you here, like a Brussels without a sprout. Nothing can stop these hard-right fools from winning. Fools from winning. Tell me, Jean-Claude, why did we vote out? I could reach out my hand to Donald Trump, you see. But they'd only remind me he's crude. I went to Dr. Liam, and guess what he told me? Guess what he told me? He said, girl, the single market is done. The customs union too. Oh, God, we're screwed. 'Cause nothing compares. Nothing compares to the EU.
Theresa May there, the artist formerly known as the Prime Minister with a working majority.
Strong and stable!
So, Hillary Clinton was in the UK this week, and although she broke her toe while she was here, which is presumably God's way of telling her not to stand again, the Russians have denied any involvement in any way. Nigel Farage, meanwhile, said that Clinton should recognise that it's over and stand down. You know, there's nothing like being mansplained to by a man who stood for election 7 times and lost every single time. So Hillary Clinton said this week that the only way to get sexism out of politics is to get more women into politics. Anna, is she right?
Look, I'm a big fan of Hillary Clinton, and we do need more women in politics, and we need good role models as well. I think my only comment about Hillary is that it actually boiled down to Hillary in the end. That's why she lost, because unfortunately she stood by her man and she should have broken free from her man and she should have condemned the stuff that Bill did when he was president.
Do you think that was really
be her own woman?
Do you think that's really the thing that brought her down in the end?
Yeah. I do, actually, because I think it showed a flaw in her, and it looked like she was just going to be Bill Mark II, and she wasn't the great, strong woman, which I think she is, and she was overly processed as well. So
Helen,
she never really smacked it back to Trump. She should have taken no shit from Trump, and she did. She was too good. She was too goody. She was too controlled.
Yeah, I did like when she did that tweet, which she just said, delete your account. That was maybe my favourite Hillary moment of the election. But I don't think we can discount the sexism as a thing. I think the problem is that I think there are people who just have a kind of reflexive kind of Pavlovian jerk whenever she mentions sexism, because there are other problems as well. And they think if you acknowledge that, then you're saying there aren't any other problems. But also I think we should acknowledge white resentment as a huge motivating factor in some of those states. Because actually, if you look at Trump's performance, the fascinating thing is he did about as well as you'd expect a generic Republican candidate to do. He didn't ride in on some amazing populist surge. Actually, after two terms of a Democrat, he did about as well as you would expect.
Mm. And just, look, we, all three of us women, Fred is like the token man in the room right now.
So this is what it feels like.
Yes, yeah. This is what structural oppression feels
right.
like. What's it like being the only man in the room?
Never mind more women in politics. I think you need one more woman in podcasts.
Well, I'm trying to fight that corner. Now, we have all been in politics in various ways. And I think part of the problem is that there is still a lot of structural sexism in politics. I mean, that phrase in the room, I've actually written a whole show about it. I think in quite a lot of the meetings I was in, there weren't a lot of women in the room. Anna, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I just honestly have never found a problem in the Tory party, genuinely. I'm not saying they haven't found a problem in Parliament, and I think that some men in Parliament on all sides are overly aggressive. They've got far, far too much testosterone and need to grow up. But actually, in the Tory party, I mean, I have to say, first woman leader, Tory and Prime Minister, and now the second. And I personally have never found that problem. And I left the Tory party for about 25 years and came back, but I never found it a problem.
One of the things I think is different about the Tory party, and I remember having this conversation with quite senior female Labour politicians, is that the Tory party's got kind of a model for what a strong woman looks like, right? It's got that Iron Lady archetype, and that's why there was all that stuff when Theresa May came in. And, you know, I think about Women to Win and about what Baroness Ann Jenkin of the Tory party's done with that. There is a kind of model of a kind of battle axe, right, in the nicest possible way.
Excuse
in the, but you know what I mean? I think but the Labour...
That's a horribly sexist expression.
I am an aspirant battle axe. I live one day to be a battle axe.
Do you know who I live to be? Baroness Trumpington.
Yeah.
Well, she's marvellous. But,
whereas in Labour, there is no model of
no,
that.
No, there's a problem in Labour. It's like the great Jess Phillips said, the biggest sexists are actually the hard left. And there always has been. I'm old enough to have been involved in politics back in the, dare I say, the 70s. Mm-hmm. And the left, there were hardly any great, strong women in the left. And there was this problem with the old sort of Clause 4 Stalinist, you know, yeah. We used to call them tankies, they used to rumble around, often Scots.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, but they, you know, I was
Anna's really going for it now.
I was involved in Scottish politics, uh-huh. And I'm very odd because I was an English Tory that won an election in Scotland in the early 80s. This was obviously a huge shock, Stirling University. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was because the main opponent was one of those all tanky sort of, you know, not very...
Out of the mains.
Yeah, and on social justice, what's this weird woman? You know, she should be in the kitchen
but
making, you
Anna,
know,
what I would what I would say on that, I agree. I think the Labour Party has got clearly a weird blind spot on women leadership. At Labour Party conference, we had a meeting, right, a load of women, and we said, how do you think we could ever get a female leader? Do you think we could have an all-women shortlist? And someone went, I think Jeremy would still win, to be honest.
This is Strong and Stable.
So obviously the world's been rocked by these shock revelations that a revolting old movie mogul has allegedly been up to no good. But it's opened up a bigger conversation about sexism in all of these industries. And lots of people have come out and... My favourite, this is Gráinne Maguire did a great tweet saying, put Woody Allen, the one celebrity who definitely can't use as the father of a daughter line to prove he cares about women, because he ended up marrying his own daughter. Now, Fred, you are the dad of a daughter.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the prospect of your daughter going out into this sexist world?
Concerned, obviously, you know, as a father of a daughter, and I just say I love her very much. No intentions of marrying her under any circumstances. She's 31 years old. She's been in the workplace a long time. She hasn't come to me with any tales of sexism. I have been hearing people
all this week with the hashtag MeToo, saying what are men saying about this? I've heard people saying, well, you know, back when I started work in the late 70s and 80s, it was a different climate and things went on. And I've been racking my brains, and I don't think I've ever seen anything or been involved in anything that I would think would be criminal, which is what these guys are up to.
But, you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting is actually we're all shocked for a while, for a couple of days. We're all in kind of, you know, social media shock. But then the world moves on. And I was pretty shocked by James Corden, who decided to kind of laugh it up in terms of what, as a comedian, what did you think of that?
Well, the second most shocking thing about that was that he was described as a comedian.
I've got to read this tweet out. Somebody said, it's nice to see James Corden finally getting the recognition he deserves.
Right. Well, you know, interestingly, Michael Shea discussed Weinstein and made jokes about it on Saturday Night Live. Now, Michael Shea is a brilliant stand-up. I've had the pleasure of working with him several times over the years. But, you know, he is, and it's a word that I've used, he's invested in his comedy.
Now, people always go that, don't they? They do that. You can't joke about anything. And it's like, well, no, you can't make lazy jokes about stuff. Right. And actually what people are attacking there is bad comedy.
And exactly.
You wouldn't get anybody, a true stand-up, coming out 24 hours later and saying, I'm sorry, I'm really, you know, holding your hand up.
Absolutely.
They were committed to their material. Yes. Yeah. He wasn't.
Yeah. Now, it's time to go over to our roving reporter, Jonathan Pye. And just a warning, Jonathan's report does contain usage of the C word. No, not Corden.
With calls for President Trump to apologise for his remarks, we now go to our Washington correspondent, John Whitechapel.
Tough to find the words sometimes, isn't it? You know, the right words to sum up Trump. I mean the right words. You know, I mean, every week I find it harder and harder and harder to find the words. I mean, this week it's like any other, isn't it? In a week where the President of the United States demonstrated that he doesn't actually know which bits of the planet he is president of. A week where he joked in public about his vice president wanting to hang all gay people. Depressing? Is that the right word? It's depressing how bad he is. You know, whatever your politics, right wing, left wing, red state, blue state, he transcends all of that. He transcends politics because he's not a politician. He doesn't have a diplomatic bone in his body. He doesn't possess a single tactful atom. And the lies, the blatant lies. This week, he lied about how he's the best at phoning the parents of dead soldiers and then demonstrated he isn't by consoling a dead soldier's parent by saying, well, he knew what he signed up for. I mean, coming from Trump, that is amazing because he clearly didn't know what he was signing up for. He doesn't know how the office of the president works. He doesn't know how an international treaty works. He doesn't understand how Congress works, how the law works. He doesn't understand how to behave properly. I've got it. I found the words. He's a lying, ignorant cunt. There you go. What? Yeah, I know it's offensive. Good. It's meant to be. If there's a more offensive word, please let me know, because he'll be that too. Whatever the word is, it will be appropriate to Trump. He lied about how he's the best at phoning the parents of dead soldiers and then joked about hanging gay people. He's a cunt. Thanks, John. Well, closer to home to...
Strong and stable.
Now, Donald Trump is 71, although, of course, his wife and his hair are much younger. But over in Austria, Sebastian Kurz is set to become the world's youngest leader. Kurz is only 31, which surely offers hope to ambitious and politically engaged young people everywhere. Although in bad news, he may be about to form a coalition with former Nazis. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. It gives a whole new meaning to the word Hitler Youth, to be honest. Now, guests, what do we think about the cult of youth in politics? Anna, I'd like to start with you. Does age matter in politics?
No, it shouldn't matter, young or old. The thing is, though, obviously, if you're young, you don't tend to have the experiences as somebody who is much older. And whilst I don't have a problem with younger people coming into politics, and good luck to them, I do want to see more people who are not career politicians. I want people with more life experiences. I would say that, given I'm 60. And I've only been in Parliament 7 years, and I did two other things beforehand. But no, in all seriousness, it's about balance, isn't it? And should there be no bar, whatever your age is, young or old, and, you know, some of the best people in Parliament, some of the wisest and the most strong are people like, of course, the great Ken Clark. 77.
But also, I think you're right in that it's a balance, because you're actually having, again, it's the same thing, you can talk about diversity in journalism, cognitive diversity and just diversity of life experiences is really important. One of the things that always used to really irritate me when you'd have a question time and they talk about housing, for example, is that the voice of people who rented was never there, right? Because everybody on that panel would own a house, because, and almost, you know, MPs, most of them have two homes, you know, and own two homes,
no,
often,
we don't.
Or, well...
Sorry.
So, okay.
No, seriously, we really don't own two homes.
No, but, okay, so own one home.
We rent one.
Yeah.
Which you pay for, which we're very grateful for.
It's been Spanish.
And then we have one home.
But what I mean is, I think that gives you a different... I think if particularly if you are in the private rented sector and that's your only sort of... You don't have any capital in a house, that gives you a very different experience. And actually, it's really important to have that experience represented. So that's why I'm really happy there are quite some younger MPs whose friendship groups will probably be people who are all in that private rented sector.
My children are 26 and 27, so I get a lot of stuff back from them.
And Fred, don't you think, though, it's an amazing situation that all our political... leaders are quite elderly at the moment. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all getting on a bit, but you know, 68 David Davis is looking like kind of a child prodigy in the Tory party. What do you think about that? Do you think it's good to have? Because remember, we had a generation of quite young guys. We had Cameron and Clegg in the early 40s. Guys, they were guys.
So when I were a lad, you know,
back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Harold Wilson, Jim Callaghan, Michael Foot. Yeah, they were all ancient, you know, they were old. But you appreciated that they'd had, as Anna was saying, the life experience. Kurtz, I'm not so sure about him. I mean, it's a dreadful thing to do, but I just took a look at his photo and I thought, oh, I don't like the look of him.
Why? You know,
I don't like him. He looks like somebody that just failed narrowly to get the part of the American Psycho. You know? He's like Conway in House of Cards. I 7 years at university without getting a degree, and this guy's now going to be leader of a European country. It's all a bit concerning.
It is much more whether or not you can connect with people and whether you actually listen and have normal friends and you understand what's going on, whatever your age may
be. And that
be.
can be an ageless quality. I mean, Fred, Mary Black in the SNP, she's very young, she's very popular. What do you think of her?
I'm growing to like Mary very much. You know, I was going to say that what you want in a young politician is somebody that is very clear in their outlook, somebody that's got strong opinions, perhaps a bit visionary. Is that a bit much to ask as well?
Steady,
Mary. I mean, when she came to the fore, I mean, there was all the stuff about the tweet she had made, which was great fodder for me as a stand-up, you know, to use another expletive. She had tweeted a number of years ago that the nuns can get to fuck, right? Now, I didn't know whether she meant that the nuns should...
Anna is looking quite bewildered at this stage.
Well, I'm not quite... got over the C word, which I absolutely hate. I don't mind the F word.
That's right. Which was an entirely correct opinion.
Woke up this morning with, what was it, two cans of lager, a slice of pizza and more money than I went out with last night. Hashtag result.
That was good.
And if you don't like the C word, trunt. Just use that, Anna. that covers it nicely.
Do you think you can be too old for politics?
Don't think so, no. And, you know, as long as you've still got your faculties.
And your teeth.
Well, you're disadvantaging a lot of old Scottish people then. You know, we've lost them by the time we're 40. I don't think you can be too old. I think, again, like we've said many times today, a balance, you know, some old, some young. Maybe there should be an average age for a politician.
Or maybe you have to have a mix. Maybe you should have a mix. Yeah. If you've got a leader, an older leader, maybe you should have a younger deputy. But turning to America, I mean, we've just had, you know, we've got Trump, we had Bernie Sanders, Hillary. Do you think the Democrats need to look for somebody who is just much younger to inject sort of fresh blood in the next round of elections?
Yes, they do. But the problem is that they're stuck. They're still stuck. And actually, the fact that Bernie's talking about running again is a kind of an extraordinary thing. The problem is, and this comes back to the Hillary problem, about the fact that she has had all this, you know, she is Hillary Clinton, and lots of people have strong opinions on that. The problem is that could anybody who hadn't been married to a previous president have got into the position that she did? And that's the real problem, is that because they don't have quite the same cabinet system in the way that we do. I mean, they do have a cabinet, but it doesn't work quite the same way. It's quite hard for people to get name recognition. So there's lots of younger Democrats who are kind of kicking around, but they, in terms of national name recognition, no. And you have the money, amount of money you have to spend in a presidential campaign is absolutely incredible.
What about young Kennedy? There must be Kennedys coming through the fore, is there not?
Well, there's always a Kennedy kicking about, isn't there? Well, look, On that note, I think we are going to have a surge of youth in politics. Obviously, we've got Sebastian Kurz. We've just had that woman who's going to be the Prime Minister in New Zealand. And it will reassure everybody hugely to remember that Kim Jong-un is only 34.
Strong and stable.
Right, we are now reaching the end of the show and we have a very exciting game to play. Are you excited? Are you excited?
Yes, yes.
The game is called Who Said It This Week? Okay, right, I am going to start with you, Anna. Who said, or rather who called Labour supine in vertebrate protoplasmic jellies for refusing to rule out paying a £100 billion Brexit bill?
Our foreign secretary, one Boris Johnson.
Ding! Correct. That's right. Supine in vertebrate protoplasmic jellies. If you catch them live, they're amazing. I saw them at Glastonbury. Absolutely brilliant. Fred McCauley, who said he knew what he signed up for?
That was the aforementioned Trunt. Can I? And also, you know that I was an accountant for a number of years, and I know all these delaying tactics. So when he stood the other day and said, "I've written to these people, and the letters will go out today or tomorrow," do you know what that means? It's on his to-do list, right? He hadn't written that letter at that time. It was Donald, who I don't know if you know this, but I mean his mother was a Scot.
Yes.
His grandmother was a Macaulay.
From
the same village in Western Isles as my great grandfather. No, we're not, thankfully. But trust me, I've spent hours in the Registrar of Scotland's offices researching.
Just going, please don't make us related.
You don't have the look of a Trunt.
No, we don't. I'm from a family of very proud, bald men.
Also, can I see your hands just to check the size?
Massive.
They're massive. We can definitely confirm there is no genetic connection.
Unfortunately, I've got a small winky.
And all your own teeth. Now, Helen, This is very exciting. Who, or more precisely, what, said NATO has been the linchpin and institutional expression of American imperialism?
I hate myself for knowing this. I hope you realise
I love the fact that you do.
It's the Young Labour Students Group who passed a motion condemning our membership of NATO.
Yeah, well done, Helen. This week, Young Labour voted to leave NATO. I didn't even realise they were in NATO, honestly. The cheeky little
seat on the Security Council.
I know. One minute they're with their fidget spinners and getting off with each other. Next, it's like, ooh, let's all turn our back on multilateralism. I mean, that's how it goes. And Fred, finally, who said, to be clear, sexual assault is no laughing matter?
Gosh.
James Corden.
No, it wouldn't have been James. Oh, maybe it was in his apology, but it was just, I was thrown by the to be clear, because that's usually how Theresa May starts her sentences. I'm very clear.
You are correct. It was James Corden who said, to be clear, sexual assault is no laughing matter, after making his hugely unfunny, disastrous Harvey Weinstein jokes as he tried to laugh it up. James Corden admitted to being addicted to being unfunny and promised to check his career into rehab and begged for a second chance. And that's all we have time for now. Well, until Extra Strong, Extra Stable, which you can listen to on Monday only on Deezer. Many thanks to our fantastic guests, Helen Lewis, Anna Soubry and Fred McCauley, to Jan Ravens and Jonathan Pye, and to our writers, Andrea Mann, Robin Flavel and Dan Bowman. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you've listened to it. And well, if you haven't, well, we're terribly sorry, but I'm afraid 52% of you voted for it. That's democracy. You'll just have to put up with it. That's it for this series, but don't worry, if the world continues to go to hell in a handcart, the chances are we'll be back to help make the journey that wee bit less bumpy for all of us. Until then, goodbye.
That was Strong and Stable. We'll catch you next time. Please subscribe.
Deezer. Originals.